Good morning, church. Just got back yesterday from Kenya. Pastor David sends greetings. He's there for a couple more weeks, as well as many partners. I'll show a few slides during the announcements time. Happy Lunar New Year. You know, what's funny about that is that in the Korean tradition, you gain 1 year on regular New Year's Day, January 1st, and then you're a year older at Lunar New Year, and then my birthday is in February, so by the time my birthday comes around, I age quite a bit. Yeah, I'm by Korean age, I'm about 140-something, so Elder Chung says he's the oldest man in our church. Elder Chung, I am, by the lunar calendar. Also, I think we should mention something that's happened in the last few weeks. This is not that funny, but something important. Those of you who follow me on Facebook, I said landing in Kenya a couple of weeks ago and getting off a 747 onto the tarmac reminded me of doing the same thing, getting off a 747 at LAX 40 years ago, plus to start our immigrant life. Well, in 1975, there were huge musical acts like David Bowie and the Eagles and Earth, Wind, and Fire. And just in the last few weeks, David Bowie, Glenn Frey, Maurice White all passed away. I know, so sad. It's like the soundtrack of my youth. I mean, so powerful and innovative and fun. And you know what kind of music young people listen to today? The 1975. Right? Come on. Be original, young people. What I'm scared about today is getting the hiccups. Pastor Dave and I had a chance to visit some family he and Lucy have near the border town in Tanzania, by the Tanzanian border, and we ate something that I think gave us food poisoning. So we've both had the runs and massive headaches, and I have this additional thing of hiccups, and like really violent hiccups. At some point, it becomes a double hiccup where I go, uh-uh. And I'm afraid that that's going to happen while I preach. So it was so bad last night. I kept keeping Sunbeck awake by shaking the bed so hard all night long. And then I realized, oh, that's what that song by AC/DC was about. You shook me all night long. As somebody whose spouse had interminable hiccups, it's like, oh, after all these years, oh, man. Anyway, we're going to get to the Bible, I promise. So, today is Transfiguration of the Lord Sunday. It's where we mark the time before Lent where Jesus in prayer is kind of in a confab with two other great figures in the Bible, Moses and Elijah. So there's like two triads, right? There's Jesus with the three disciples who are the inner circle, Peter, James, and John. And then there's another triad of Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. And something, you know, when there's a divine encounter often in the Bible, it happens at mountaintops, right? And we know what happened to Moses when he met God at Mount Horeb. He got the Ten Commandments out of that. Do you know that Elijah also, when he was running away from the King Ahab and his wife Jezebel, he ran to Beersheba and then to Mount Horeb. So this is a kind of a reference to meeting God on a holy mountain. And it does say, though, that this transfiguration, meaning that there is a transformation in the figure of Jesus' body, right? But it has to do with a transfiguration of his face, that this happened first while he was praying. Right? So we think, a lot of us think that the transfiguration happened because of this magical encounter between Jesus and Moses and Elijah. But the transfiguration actually happened just as Jesus was in prayer on the mountain. This is a small point, but I would argue that all of us have the opportunity and capacity for transfiguration ourselves in prayer. And in that kind of transfigured encounter with God, who knows whom we might encounter. So in this transfigured prayer, Jesus' face changes and his clothes become a dazzling white. And suddenly, the three disciples in the inner circle, they see two men, Moses and Elijah, and they're talking to Jesus. And it says that they appeared in glory and were speaking of his departure. Do you know what this word is in Greek? It's the same word as Exodus. All right? There's Moses talking to Jesus about Exodus. Speaking of his Exodus, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Exodus also is the same word as exit, right? Now, Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleep. But since they had stayed awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. So I would say that this part is not very reliable because when we're sleepy enough, we can hallucinate, right? So the Bible isn't all that clear about what's going on here. But just as they were leaving him, Peter said to Jesus, just as this meeting is concluding, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And then it says, not knowing what he said. So he was really, really out of it. And now, you know, there's three major festivals in Jesus' time, and one of those was the Festival of Booths. And that has to do with making temporary dwelling places. This celebrates things that happened in Israel's history a long time ago. So it may be a reference to that. But it's also a proposal of making shrines to these great figures. For these inner three, they clearly saw that Jesus had truly reached greatness, right? I mean, how long has it taken for there to be a kind of settled consensus that Martin Luther King Jr. is a great figure in American history? It's pretty much settled now, right? But even a couple of decades ago, it wasn't a national, MLK Day was not a national holiday in all 50 states. And when I was growing up, it wasn't obvious that he was a great man according to American historical narrative. Remember that he was targeted by the FBI and was considered a subversive and a communist and every kind of thing under the sun. So people who do great things are controversial in their time. So were Moses, so were Elijah. But by this time, it's settled, right? Everybody agrees that Moses and Elijah are great heroes of the faith. And then Peter, James, and John see Jesus in this little confab with these two great men. So how awesome is that? Our master, the one we follow, we're part. Not only are we part of the 12 disciples, we're part of the inner circle of the three. How awesome is that? Why don't we build shrines to Moses, Elijah, and our present master, Jesus? What's wrong with that? Right? Celebrating and, in a way, enshrining the greatness of people in that way. Well, I think what's wrong with that is part of what's been wrong with the church throughout our history. We would rather make people into saints than actually follow their example. Isn't it much easier to celebrate Mother Teresa's compassion and to advocate for her sainthood, and maybe to visit her shrine if there ever is one, than actually to follow her example in some way? This creating of shrines, tokens, icons for our favorite heroes of the faith looks like adulation. It looks like respect. But actually, it's a way of dismissing their claim in our lives, their example for us to follow. By venerating them, we can then dismiss them as heroes. And as soon as we say that they are heroes, we are exempt. Well, I'm not a hero. I'm just an ordinary human being. Right? That's what happens in time. Now, the good thing is, like I said, there's settled consensus in our nation now that Dr. King was a great man, a hero even. The bad news about that is that he is no longer one of us. He's no longer a human being. He's a hero among the pantheon of human demigods. And now the kind of courage that he had, the kind of sacrifice he made, the kind of Christian witness he embodied is not relevant to us, does not apply to us. How convenient. This was a temptation then, as is now. And that's why Peter wanted to build the booths, the temporary dwellings, the shrines to these three great men. Peter was so crazy, he wanted to enshrine Jesus while Jesus was still there on earth. How about that? But we should hear the narration, right? Not knowing what he said. That's what Luke, the narrator, says. While Peter was speaking this nonsense, a cloud came down and overshadowed them. Now, you know, there's not a separate word for fog in those days, but fog is a cloud on the ground, right? So this kind of fog or mist settled around them, and they were terrified as they entered the cloud. Then from the cloud came a voice that said, "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him." Remember a similar word like this from God when Jesus was being baptized by John the Baptist? What we're not getting, the nuance we're not getting, is the phrase after that, which is, "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him, you idiots." Okay, I should translate the Bible. It'd be so much more understandable. Because Peter had just said an idiotic thing, right? So God is in heaven, smacking God's forehead, saying, "Do you not understand what is going on?" Jesus is conferring with the ancients. With ancient wisdom, Jesus is tapping into ancient faith, the ancient way of life, the ancient way of being human with one another and before God. And you guys seem more interested in creating religion, enshrining people, creating icons, and then selling it and making a living off it. This is my son. This is not a hero. This is my son. This is someone I have an ongoing active relationship with. This son of mine is conferring with me and my children, even from the distant past, drawing that wisdom from our own tradition. And what kind of conference was it? Who is Moses? Moses is the one, after being raised by the Pharaoh of Egypt and was a prince of Egypt, fled for 40 years in the wilderness, became a nobody, was so thoroughly convinced he was a nobody that he argued with God five times, until God just shut him down and just said, "Do it." And he then went back to confront his old father figure, basically. Except now, instead of looking up to Pharaoh, he looks down on him. I mean, it was a son of the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh is considered the son of God, and Moses goes to confront him. And remember that this is not just spiritual bondage. I mean, we like to spiritualize everything. This was a serious political and economic situation we have in Egypt going on here. The pharaohs at that time were intent on building monuments to themselves, massive, massive monuments to themselves. We don't have any examples of that in this country, do we? We wouldn't know what that's about. But in those days, in ancient times, powerful people loved to build massive monuments to themselves. Now, the only way you can do that when the monuments are that big is to conscript slave labor. And if you do it among your own people, you might get a lot of grumbling and maybe even a revolt or revolution. But what if you had foreign people, the others, as we like to call them, and made them into slaves, and they built the pyramids, and they did all this other stuff and built the palaces for free? Because if they don't, you kill them. That is a political and economic situation that the Israelites faced. And when Moses confronted Pharaoh, Moses was calling out the situation in political, economic, and social terms. Right? It wasn't, hey, we just want to worship, right? We want freedom of religion. I have no idea why so many people think that everything in the Bible is that spiritualized. There was a real political and economic situation going on there, and they cried out to God. They cried out to God, not because they did not have freedom of religion or freedom of speech, but because they didn't have a freedom in life. They couldn't eat. They couldn't raise their children. They were working to death, literally. They cried out to God. And God had sympathy on their political and economic situation and called Moses to obey God and to deliver the people of God. And who was Elijah? Elijah wasn't dealing with a foreign empire at this time. He was a prophet of the northern kingdom. And Ahab was the king at that time. He did have a foreign wife, Jezebel. And she was much harder and much more politically astute than her dim-witted husband Ahab was. Both were extremely oppressive and repressive. But together they made quite a formidable team. And Ahab was one of the most oppressive kings in Israelite history. And Elijah was in constant battle with Ahab and Jezebel together, whom had killed most of the prophets of the northern kingdom. And many, many other people who were trying to be faithful. And there's that scene when Elijah hides under a broom tree and all that. That's while he's running away from Jezebel's persecution. So what does it mean that Jesus is conferring with Moses and Elijah? Moses is the first person that confronts a foreign empire, the Egyptian empire. Later, there will be the Assyrian empire, Babylonian empire, the Persian empire, the Greek empire, and the Roman empire in Jesus' day. Moses is the first Israelite leader to confront a major empire in their day. What is Elijah? Elijah was one of the greatest prophets to confront an internal imperial system where Ahab was king of Israel. He himself was an Israelite, but he modeled his rule after the foreign empires around him and not the intertribal confederacy that God had set up for the Israelites post-Exodus. They were not to have kings and emperors like the other nations. They were to operate as family. They were to operate out of mutuality and trust and justice. That's what the Ten Commandments and, in fact, the whole 613 laws were about. That's what the laws were about, that God's laws would rule the people and not the arbitrary rule of a despot. But what became of these Israelite kings? they started to emulate the foreign kings and emperors around them. So for poor people, what's worse, external oppression or internal oppression? Let's do a survey. And poor people are getting screwed all the time, right? So we have internal oppression in our country. And then when we generate external wars, who are the ones that become our soldiers? The poor, right? And then we fight external wars. So the poor get screwed one way or the other. And that was a time, it was just like that now as it was then. And so what was Jesus dealing with? Jesus is dealing with the Roman Empire. That was had such an incredibly oppressive grip on the politics and the economics of ancient Palestine. But not only in the southern area, but in the northern area of Galilee. And this rule by the Roman Empire was in partnership with the religious establishment, the temple. The temple establishment was very much there because they were doing Rome's bidding. And so Elijah's voice then becomes important in dealing with the temple leadership through the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, and others that were just as intent on killing Jesus as the Roman Empire, which did not want any kind of uprising. And among all the Roman subjects throughout the centuries, the Jewish people were some of the most infamous for uprisings. So Rome was already on high alert to any kind of disturbance among the people in that area of the world. So then we have a little more context into, this is my son, my chosen, listen to him, right? He is conferring with Moses and Elijah for a reason. They're talking about some very important things, and what they're talking about is Jesus' exodus. How will Jesus exit this world in a certain way to bring new life and new creation to the world in a different way? Listen to him. When the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent, and in those days told no one any of the things they had seen. So then what are the implications? Well, the next passage is the real implication of this. I'm not sure how much these disciples understood through this very interesting interaction they had. But it says, on the very next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met Jesus. Just then a man from the crowd shouted, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. He is my only child." And then he goes on to explain. So you know this is a big deal because in those days, the family is all about passing on to the next generation. So he's only got one child, one son. And if the boy dies, then there's no way for the progeny to continue. Suddenly a spirit seizes him, and all at once he shrieks, it convulses him until he foams at the mouth, it mauls him and will scarcely leave him. So he's truly possessed by something. Now it could be epilepsy in today's terms, who knows. But the father of the boy says, "I beg your disciples to cast this thing out," but they could not. And Jesus now is all so exasperated, right? Jesus is patient, but that doesn't mean he can't get exasperated every once in a while. And I love this broadside he does of this entire generation. "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you and bear with you?" How does that sound? Jesus wouldn't say that about our generation, would he? "You faithless and perverse generation." A few thoughts I have on this. I think Jesus is saying something about all the people of that time, all the people. But it doesn't mean that Jesus believes that the origin of the problem rests with the people, right? I have some insight about this after all these years in ministry, because when I'm ministering to you, to our people, I know that we just bear the symptoms of the kind of toxic systems, the toxic society we live in, right? But still, I can't help but think, you perverse and faithless generation, right? Because out of my own exasperation. So it's just a phrase. It doesn't mean that this is the sum of Jesus' analysis of the problems of his time. But there is, I think, Jesus is making a comment about that generation's inability to see, inability to connect the dots. So the disciples, the three disciples, Peter, James, and John, can't connect the dots, right? They see Moses, Elijah, and Jesus and can't connect the dots of how they are related and why this conference is so important and what it's in preparation for. They want to make a religion out of this now. And they also can't connect the dots as to why this boy is demon-possessed. We do some really innovative and exciting reading in our underground seminary. And in one of the readings that we've come across, there is serious sociological and historical research into sub-Saharan African culture right now, where they cannot find evidence of evil spirits, demon possession, until the advent of Western colonialism. Isn't that interesting? Right? And I think when we look at the Bible carefully through that lens, we'll see that a lot of times the kind of crazy that people embody is a form of empire sickness. Right? Do we ever feel that way? I mean, the pressures of modern life, the pressures to make it, the pressures to be somebody, the pressures of competition, of the society telling us what a good life is, and then the pressure to try to live into that. It can make anybody crazy. And then all of that actually being funded in the most perverse ways possible. I've talked about that in other sermons, but we live in one of the most craziest economic arrangements possible, right? I can't resist. I have to say at least this one thing. The U.S. dollar is based on nothing, okay? I've said this before. The only thing that the U.S. dollar is based on is the promise to pay present debts with, present obligations with future debt. That's the only thing that the U.S. currency is built on. Please trust me on this or look it up yourself, okay? And how do we guarantee that we will pay our present debts with future borrowing? Because the U.S. military has bases all over the world, and anyone that actually tries to collect on our debts right now ain't going to get it. And notice why China is so active right now in building up their military, right? Because they have trillions of dollars of our money. And one day they might say, we want real money, like real stuff, right? Not just the future, that you're going to be a republic forever, and you're always going to borrow from this permanent republic that you're going to be. We want something real like Hawaii. And then we're talking about real war, right? So right now, everybody's kind of playing the game, playing the illusion that money is real and it's based on something real, but it's not. So everyone's living under an illusion and everyone's trying to make it in some way. It's very, very difficult and people are going crazy. And how many of, this statistic came out 15 years ago. A quarter, 25% of college students are on psychotropic drugs. right? Not like just some mild condition, but are actually on prescription psychotropic drugs. And it's only rising since that time. And how many of our children bear the symptoms of the craziness of an imperial lifestyle? So Jesus says, you faithless and perverse generation, like you can't connect the dots, can you? You can't understand that your craziness, your anxiety, your out of control stress level, your ill mental health, your ill physical health, your inability to have meaningful relations, the fact that you hate everybody and everybody hates you. You can't connect the dots that you're part of an imperial system where the only thing that matters is what we produce for the economic and political systems around us. That is not what it means to be a human being, to be a productive member of society. You can't connect the dots. You think that this child foaming at the mouth is an individual situation. You don't understand that there are countless children foaming at the mouth right now because they are going crazy from the kind of system that they're growing up in, from the kind of pressures that they have at home, at school, at church, everywhere they go. People are going crazy. The ones who have it put together are the ones who are foaming at the mouth inside and swallowing it before it comes out. But everybody's foaming at the mouth. Everyone's got empire sickness. You faithless and perverse generation, when are you going to be able to connect the dots and see that all of us are sick in this way? And that's why these disciples could not heal this boy. That's why so many of us, that's why the church, for most of our history, have been so ineffective at true liberation and salvation and healing for people. Because the empire is oppressing all of us at one time, but then convinces us of the ideology of individualism. It's the oldest trick in the book, right? The system is creating all our problems, but then it tells us that your problem is your own because you're incompetent, because you're not clever enough, because you're not working hard enough, because you're not faithful enough. Bring your son here. While he was coming, the demon dashed him to the ground in convulsions. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit. The unclean spirit of his day, Jesus has the power to rebuke the unclean spirit of our day too. And he healed the boy and gave him back to his father. Family was restored. Family was restored. Kinship. And all were astounded at the greatness of God. What an amazing thing it would be for the Church of Jesus Christ to generate these kinds of miracles and healing in our midst, that people around us would be astounded at the greatness of God. We belong to the Presbyterian Church USA, the PCUSA. We're a 1.5 million member denomination. We're still in the top 10 in terms of size. We're 10th, actually. Do you know that since 2011, we have been losing 100,000 members a year? Before that, it was anywhere from 60 to 80. Right now, we're losing 100,000 members a year. Anybody know math a little bit? We have 1.5 million members. We're losing 100,000 members a year. We have about 15 years before we hit zero. In 20 years, we could have minus 500,000 members. That's going to be a fun denomination to be a part of, right? Okay. I mean, it's crazy. We were just, Pastor Dave and I were in Kenya for 2 weeks, and the church is growing everywhere. And they have such a desperate need for pastors. We were at this lay training center in Kikuyu, where dozens and dozens of elders would be in this week-long immersion experience for training in the sacraments and preaching and all kinds of things, because they just simply don't have enough pastoral leaders to do this kind of work. And here our churches are being converted into bars and bookshops and coffee shops and, you know, nice things, I guess, but houses of worship that are to embody the power of God, the power of Jesus to heal the sicknesses in our day. But we're just like in those days, really just a faithless and perverse generation, aren't we? We just simply don't have the capacity to connect the dots and actually help our people. And that's why we need to be here. That's what the church is about, right? To hear from the clouds a voice, listen to him. This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him. We're such an obtuse generation that we just have to come here week after week to be able to see. I know that the younger generation, more and more, is not a very church-going generation. I recognize that. But we should also remember that injunction, that let us not fail to meet together, as is the habit of some. If we were that clear-minded, that insightful, maybe it wouldn't need such frequency. But we're just not that good. I'm not that good. I need you to help me see. We need each other to be able to connect the dots. Let us not fail to meet together as we do, so that we can truly bring God's healing in this desperately sick generation for the glory of God. Amen. Let us pray.